My name is Ralph White. I'm an alcoholic. And just briefly, had a couple of people I spoke to yesterday, and somebody was, should I bring my book? Will we be highlighting? Will we be underlining? And if somebody is wondering, wow, we've taken a journey through the book, but we're not actually going through the book. And B, this is, you know, we get the opportunity to do these deals, and we really go where we're directed, and in the amount of time that we have, we're talking about where this book and what we've done through the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous to change, transform our lives, because it's a transformative process. So we really are not going to get to talk that much about the mechanics of the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous, the mechanics of four-step and the rest of that. But we'll talk about it as this, like I said, this transformative vehicle, and let you see what it's done in our lives and how important it is, as well as some of the other experiences that we've had as a result of applying what's in that book. I think we left off yesterday. And there's a chapter. First, we talked about step one. Ronnie, you know, when he talks that about the deal with my mom, and I've heard it a lot of times, and every time I see it, you know, if there was a chapter that had surrender, you know, I think that the picture of him being stomped and my mother turning her back would probably be the illustration for that one. And when I was listening to Kent last night and we were talking, and he talked about, and there's a theme, I guess, that runs through that, because he talked about when he said to his mom, I broke you, and I'm a little disappointed. It wasn't even that hard. That hits me in my core, and that to me is like, that's alcoholism. That's what it does. That's how it looks with a face, you know. And so one of the things that I am really excited about when I get to talk about this process that you guys introduced me to, I talk about it in a dynamic way, in an alive way. And we get the opportunity, a little bit at home, we get the opportunity to sit with some men and women every Sunday morning and actually go through this deal page by page, line by line. And the first step is the problem. But surrender isn't achieved in the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, the act of surrender, which is, you know, that's the pre-step. Step one is not the first step in recovery. Step one, admitted that I'm powerless over alcohol and my life has become unmanageable. There's a step eight, it's the first step in recovery, fully conceding to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. And it doesn't take place in the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. I give it a name in the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. But for each and every one of us sitting out here, it took place somewhere in my life. And really it takes place somewhere internally. And I think that thing of surrender is not so much a voluntary statement. Surrender is not something that you think about when you read the book. Surrender is kind of, for people like us, surrender is extracted. You know what I'm saying? Surrender is extracted. Now, if one of you pretty ladies, as if you're sitting here and you seducing me, and I say, oh, no, I shouldn't, and then you persist, and I say, okay, I surrender to you. That's a level of surrender that ain't the surrender that's required. That voluntary giving over of myself for something I want, that's a different one. The surrender that's required in that first step, that I get the opportunity, and sometimes, you know, the last vestige of I can do this thing by myself takes place when I read the information that's in this book. But what takes place, but the first step is lived. you know, and like I said, it's extracted, you know, unwillingly too. Sometimes it remind me of if you look at a movie and you see somebody getting ready to get tortured, you know, I'm torture you for information, you know, and when we're looking at the movie, you're like, just give it up now because you're going to just save yourself all that goddamn, you know, physical pain. You know, you just going to, right? And that would sound like it should work, you know, the same way with this disease that I suffer from. Just give it up now. You'll save yourself all the pain. But the catch 22 in the disease of alcoholism is this. Although it's killing me, what it is that it's doing to me, it feels to me as if the torture occurs when I leave it alone. It feels that that's the catch 22 of this disease that I suffer from. And so finally, that's why it's such a beat down kind of deal. And so beat down under the lash of alcoholism, which is the problem. Step one is the problem. I'm driven to the solution. I ain't got nowhere else to go. I didn't come in here out of virtue, and I didn't come in here looking for the solution, and I didn't come in here looking for a life of recovery and a life of surrender. I didn't even know what that looked like. I came in here running from the disease of alcoholism. And whatever was waiting on me on the other side, what was waiting on me on that side got to be so goddamn untenable. I don't care. I don't care. And so I go in here and I get to this and new friends, and we had a number of new friends here yesterday. You know, step two is the solution. And step two is also a conclusion I draw based on my experience. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the best place to find step two, if you're having a problem, the best place is our fourth chapter, We Agnostics. And sometimes some folk think, now people come in classifications. You know, you got your atheist. And an atheist believes that he can prove the non-existence of God. Believes it's proof. I can prove there ain't no God. Then on the other end of the spectrum, true believers. I ain't got to have proof. I got faith. I know that there is one. I don't care what you say. I can prove that there is a God. You know, and the proof is in the faith that I... And then somewhere in the middle of that is the agnostic. Yeah, can't prove the existence or the non-existence of this power. Then some working definitions for agnostics for people like us. Not so wordy because, you know, sometimes, you know, I'm not trying to fool with this God idea, but I really ain't going to try to fool with this atheist thing. Number one, it takes too much work. You got to do a lot of studying to hold up your end of the argument. You know, no. And then if you raised like me and Ronnie, you know, I'm raised Southern Baptist. You know, I'm marched off to church every Sunday morning. Sunday school, church, evening service, dinner at church, BTU choir. I'm like, oh my God, you know, that's one of my earliest prayers, you know, because we didn't have a car. So my grandfather took all of us to church, and I'd be praying, let granddaddy's car break down on the way. I would, you know, I'd be like, God, and he had an old reliable son, just made it to church every Sunday. And I said, when Ralph White turns 16 years old, you'll never have to worry about him darkening the doors of anybody else's church. Religion is an opiate of the people. I'd rather smoke mine. Thank you very much. You know, I'm coming up in the 60s, and you say all the stuff, you know, but I said it, did admit it, didn't show up in anybody else's church, went about my business, went about this business of life as I was living it, and then went about this business of slow death as I was dying it, and I'm doing the deal, and I hit these rooms, and I get squarely confronted, so now I'm toe up, and I'm beat down, and I'm like, I give, please, somebody help me get the gorilla off me, you know, and so I'm confronted in that second, in that chapter four, you know, if when I want to, I can't control the amount I'm drinking. That's me. If when I sincerely don't want to start again, I honestly can't quit on my own. That's me. Then I'm probably alcoholic. If that be the case, then you may be suffering from an illness that only a spiritual experience to conquer. We stopped on that note yesterday. Only a spiritual experience to conquer. Whole deal. Whole deal. That's the whole deal. Only a spiritual experience to conquer. You know, and so the whole deal is only a spiritual experience. And I've tried. Kent went through some of the other experiences last night. The fear experience, the self-knowledge experience, the falling in love experience, the having the baby experience, the having the family experience, the getting the job experience, the having physical exercise experience, the having some money. All of them kept getting loaded, kept getting loaded, kept getting loaded, kept getting loaded. So I'm sitting up here with this one, you know, and the only thing that will make a guy like, and it's a strange sentence in that chapter, we agnostics, to be doomed to die an alcoholic death or to live life on a spiritual basis are not always easy. And that seems strange, doesn't it? Doomed to die alcoholic death, slow death, dead man walking, dead man just won't, not no quick instantaneous death. No, this death is going to be people talking about you, man. Boy, you need to do that kind of humiliation death over and over and over again. That death, you know, to be doomed to die like that or to live life are not always easy alternatives. It would seem that that's life or death. You know, what's so hard about that? I come into you guys. Is there a door number three? Come on now, you know. Gotta be, you know, gotta be. Yeah, I said I'd do anything, but come on, why you gotta go there? Not the G word, not the God idea. And it's not so much that the proposition is to live, to be doomed to die alcoholic death or to live life. That's not the proposition. It's not to be doomed to die or to live life. They append that other little piece at the end. Or to live life on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives. And why aren't they easy alternatives? When are alternatives not easy? When I was a kid, you can take this castor oil or this cod liver oil. Really? Mr. Lee, bam, we sentence you. What do you want, gas chamber or electric chair? What choice is that? Sit you in a room, Debbie, we were going to have to listen to Liberace or Perry Como. God damn, somebody went way back. Somebody went way back. See, these youngsters don't know nothing about that. I don't know what to tell them. Perry Como. I like that. I like that. But when are alternatives not easy? You know, alternatives are not easy when they look exactly the same or when they look equally distasteful. They look exactly the same. And to be doomed to die an alcoholic death for folk like us or to live life on a spiritual, that's the same as dying. That's the same thing. Same thing. Life on a spiritual basis. Mean no women, no fun, no chase, no nothing that I like to do. You know, I don't even want that. And here's the other piece to it. Not only don't I not want it, I can't do it. Don't want it, can't do it. Cold place. So what would make a guy like me turn his head in that direction? The negative second step. The negative second step. I had come to believe, already came to believe, this is another coming to believe, in the hopelessness and futility of life as I had been living it. I had come to believe that come 3 o'clock in the morning, you find me walking the streets around my block with the rest of the folks. Bill called it the sots, you know, the procession of sots, you know. We don't use that word, thank God. I don't even like it. But I was in the procession, you know. I had come to believe that tomorrow is going to look like yesterday, which looks like today. I had come to believe that Christmas is going to look like next Wednesday. They're going to all look. I had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility. It's hopeless and futile. Ain't nothing going on for real. And I had come to believe it was just going to be that way from now on. That's it. That's all. And it was nothing left for me to do but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools. And I didn't say it like that. I said, if you got something for me. And in the chapter, we agnostics, for anybody who's having problems with the G word, problems with the God idea, thinking that I just took a wrong turn. I came up in here because I was having a serious problem with alcohol, and you guys want to introduce me to the same thing that I was being introduced to when I was 5 and 6 years old. What kind of thing is that? You know, anybody having a problem? In the chapter, we agnostics, the thing that the book sets forth there, when Bill wrote that chapter, he talked in pragmatic. But see, I'm not the ought to guy. For me, when ought to meets want to always wins out. I'm just the want to guy. I'm not the ought to guy. You ought to do this. You ought to do that. I'm not the one. You know, but one of the reasons why I like what this book does is a pragmatic book. It's practical. And it talks about things. It talks about why it makes more sense than less to believe in a power. Why it is more productive to believe than not to believe. Starts outlining a series of things for a guy like Ralph. First thing it says is ask yourself what the spiritual terms mean to you. I would bristle when somebody got up to the podium and talked way too religious, and I'd say, oh, no, I'm not feeling. What is that thing? What does it mean to you, Ralph? You know, and I had to start getting this concept of this power. I love when Deborah was talking the other night because she went at length and she started talking about the expansion of a concept. And what she really talked about is what I really want. We talk about a coming to believe, but that's not an end in and of itself. For folk like us, if you're going to be on this road to recovery, it's for grown people. It's not for weak people. You know, and I used to think the religious way was the way of the weakness. You know, if you're going to get on this thing called recovery, put your big girl panties on and put your big boy pants on, because it's for grown people, and it's for people who have lives, and it's for people who want to be parents, and it's for people who want to be, you know, productive. It's for people who want to go to work. It's for people who want to stand up. It's for people who want to hold their heads up. It's for people who want to be self-supporting again. It's for people who want to be able to stand up in their own life and be who it is that God intended me to be. And I thought it was the way of weakness, and I never knew that. And so I got involved with this deal. And in that chapter, it talked about, Ralph, I'm going to give you a roadmap to a power. Because for a guy like me, you may have heard the word, and it may be true, that they say sometimes God, you know, won't give you more than you can handle. That might be true, but life will. That's why you need God. And I got embarked on that journey to get in touch with this power. And it started giving me some building blocks, some basic ways to get in touch with that power in that chapter. And it said, Ralph, be quick to see where religious people are right. So I turn on a dime all the things that I used to think of as weaknesses in this religion. I used to talk about my grandfather and my grandmother. Ronnie, and see, Ronnie, when he talked, sometimes we'd just be talking too fast. He said my father was a high school dropout. No, he wasn't. My father never even made it to high school. My father didn't make it out of elementary school. You know, my father didn't even make it to middle school. And I thought church was for folk like that. Church was for, you know, for folk from the South that migrated to Los Angeles. And so now you need a preacher to tell you how to live your life because you don't know how to. You're not as slick as me. You're not as cool as me. You're not the new generation. You're not the young generation. Granddaddy, that's cool for you to be in church. Grandmama, that's cool for you to be in church. Mama, I love you, but church is cool for you, but you just don't understand. I'm not rolling like that. You know, and in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, be quick to see where religious people are right. They've been exhibiting a degree of stability, usefulness, and happiness. LO 63992. Old folk in here recognize when phone numbers used to have letter prefixes. Remember, Bill? LO 63992. That's my grandparents' phone number. They had it for 50-something years. I still know it right now. They had one phone number my whole life, and they had it before me, and they had it, you know, and they had it when they were gone. Stayed in one place. One address, 1726 East 107. I can't tell you all addresses and all the phone numbers I've had, you know. Can't tell you. Exhibiting a degree of stability. I used to say to myself, Granddaddy, I make more in a year than you gonna make in a 20-year span. And I used to be derisive about that. And it dawned on me as I was going through that chapter. As much as I talk about Granddad, I make more money than you. You're not as slick as me. You're not as sharp as me. And he would be in that church and he was the deacon every Sunday morning. And check this out. Granddaddy never asked me for bail money. A degree of usefulness, stability, happiness. 55 years to one woman. Whoo! I remember my grandma. And that's where I went, and that was my refuge. That was the place I could go, because it was six in a little two-bedroom apartment. And those two Southern folk, plain-spoken folk, who talked all the time about, don't worry about it, give it to God, give it to God, give it to God. You know, and I started looking, and I was quick to see where religious people started expanding. You know, got as open-minded on the idea of this God thing as I had tried to be on other things. And I was a modern-day guy, and I used to think I have to understand everything. And how many people in here believe that the electricity is on right now? In here, who believes the electricity is on in this hotel right now? Why you believe it? Can you see the electricity? Huh? Can anybody in here see the electricity? Well, how you know that the electricity's on? You can see what? Can see the results. Can see the results. If you're sitting in here right now and you having a problem with the God idea, can't see him, can't touch him, look at the lights. Look at the lights. Look at the lights. The lights are on. The lights are on. You can see the results. And when thousands and thousands and millions of men and women can stand up in front of Ralph White and say that the single most important fact in their life today is the absolute certainty that their Creator has entered their heart and life in a way that's a deeper, that I'm not stupid. I'm not stupid. You know, I look real crazy saying, oh, he ain't, you know, that's like the white people looking at the Wright brothers. Ain't nobody going to fly and looking at the airplane up in the, nah, that ain't, I ain't seeing that. That's Photoshop. Y'all ain't Photoshop. And when you listen to Kent's story, didn't nobody pay him to come up in here? And wouldn't nobody say that if it didn't really happen? So I come out of that chapter, and there's a lot more meat in that chapter. There's a lot more meat in that chapter. Deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of this power, and he either is or he isn't. What was my choice to be? I always puzzled over that. He is. If he is, how is that a choice for me? Because if I choose that he ain't, he ain't. Now, God is, but if I operate as if he's not, guess what? I'm going to get the results as if he's not. You know, faith without works is dead, and that's what it's going to look like for me. So I get propelled out of that chapter, and you ain't got to believe God is going to work for you to work for you. You know, the results of step two aren't taken when you do step two. The results of step two are found at the end of step nine. You know, by now sanity is returned. So I do some stuff. You know, that process of 3 through 10 will get me to that coming to believe. So how do I come to believe? How do I make that happen? Take some actions. You ain't gotta believe in the actions. You ain't gotta believe in the actions. Take the actions. Treat it like cake mix. Get a box, pour it in a bowl. You ain't gotta believe it. If the directions say put an egg in there, put an egg in there. If the directions say put a stick of butter, put a stick of butter. If the directions say, you know, sit up here and beat it, beat it. If the directions say turn the oven on to 375, do that. Stick it in the pan, stick it in the oven. If it say put it in 40 minutes, put it in 40 minutes, come back. You ain't even gotta believe you'll get a cake. Just follow some directions. Just follow some directions. Just follow some directions. You ain't got to believe in the power to start. And I love it. It say this is all we need to commence at the beginning. I used to think I got to believe like granddaddy. I got to have as much. No, I don't. No, I don't. I can commence. How do we know that's true? Because there's so many of us in here. I commenced to get results well before I was believing or had a relationship with this. Because I'm after relationship. Well before. Well before. In fact, some folk will say the book keeps me so. No, it don't. I'm going to say something else that might be controversial. Some folk will say the steps got me sober. No, they didn't. Matter of fact, nobody comes to the steps still drinking. Guarantee you everybody in here approached the steps already abstinent. How did that happen for me? God's grace. God's grace. There's something that happens. There's something that happens for each and every one of us. there's a process. I think when desperation meets opportunity, there's a window of grace that opens up then. And if you're fortunate and if you choose it, you jump through that window. It opened for me a number of times, and I waited too long. But on October 11th, 1986, I jumped through the window. And from that moment to this one, what I've been doing is clearing the channel. Grace is grace. God does one thing. He guides, and that's what he does, grace. Grace is always, what's blocked is the receiver. God is always sending. When folks say to me, you know, oh, you know, when it's my time, when God want me to be sober, and then I don't argue. I go inside myself and say, what's my concept? Why wouldn't God ever want me to be sober? Folk be saying, we the chosen few. Again, I go inside my concept. What kind of God is that? You know, I'm going to pick Ronnie. My brother Reggie is still struggling, but I'm not going to pick Reggie. What kind of God is that? No. No, we not the chosen few. We the few who chose. I choose God. Just like Bill Wilson when he stood in that hotel lobby and the drink was calling and the thought was calling. He chose the thought of finding one of us. And when that ass is whooped, you might choose right too. That is the great determinant. So I come out of that second step and I go into step three. Made a decision to turn my will, which is my thinking and my life, which is my actions, over to the care of God as I understood him. Didn't need to understand him at that time. Whatever the rudimentary idea is, and the way that I give legs to that third step is I was in Vegas and I was sitting at a table. Blackjack is what I do when I'm in Vegas. And this is before, and I don't do it much, and I'm so grateful. You know, I'm so grateful because when I first got sober, I got so much that goes on. Anything I like doing, I overindulge in, right? So I didn't know if I had the fever or not because a lot of us, I'm not stepping on no toes, but a lot of us, you know, when we hit that table, we got the fever. And I didn't know. Thank God I found out I'm cool. You know, I can get up from the table, unlike other stuff, but I can get up. Anyway, but this is back in the life. I was at blackjack table, had a lot of chips, and I'm playing, and a guy was walking by. You know, and you probably, if you ever go, you probably see guys like this, and he had a bunch of chips, and he was walking by the table, and he just sat at our table, and he pushed all the chips in. And I was impressed. I'm like, this dude is, wow, look at what he's doing. You know, all in. And when I got with you guys, and that third step for me, I'm all in. All in. Unlike the guy with a bunch of chips, when I came to you with my first third step, I didn't feel like I had a bunch of chips. All I had was me. I had my will, and I had my life. There's some people in here that come with chips, too. It's not a requirement that you've lost everything of material value to make it to us. It helps. You know, I did. You know, but I was all in with me. And I like that idea of being all in with you guys. Because I found all in with you guys. And that's the demonstration. When it says turning my will and my life over to the care of this power, check this out. But I'm blocked by calamity and by pomp and by worship of other things. So how am I turning it over? And the expression of that turning it over to this unknown at this point power, this untrustworthy power, this non-relationship having thing that I don't have yet, the outward expression of that is I do what it is that you guys direct me to do. I do what it is you guys direct me to do. And I start taking those actions that those of you have taken who've tasted the power. I start taking the actions that you guys direct me to take, that those of you direct me who are connected to the power. And I start doing some things and my life transforms. And then one of the reasons I need that is I have to, before, you know, we talk about this third step in our big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, says being convinced that my life run on my will can hardly be a success. If your life run on your will is successful, don't do the rest of the steps. sitting here and audit the course. Just watch the rest of us. You know, you cool. Why would you? If I'm successfully doing anything, why would I do something different? So if you're successful, sponsors, don't be tripping with people when they ain't writing and not taking the rest of the steps. So maybe they successfully manage it. And you know, and if they ain't, they're going to get the results that's going to bring them back to this process that we do. You know, no amount of talking and cajoling. You know, I say that all the time. I say that all the time. But if your life is a train wreck waiting to happen like mine, you know, if your life run on your wheel, can hardly be a success, you know. And so I look at that deal, and that's who I am. I am the manager. I am what's described when we talk about that third step, the actor. But I don't think I'm the actor. I think I'm the director. And the cool thing about it is every single person in here has their own drama going on. And in your deal, you're the leading man or the leading lady. But I'm always the leading man. I don't realize that in your tip, I'm just a bit actor without a speaking role. I can't understand that, you know. I can't understand that. No, I'm the star of every, you know. And so when you operate like that, look how many people in here are leading men and leading ladies and running everybody else's shit. So it's obvious that we're going to be in collision. Don't we have to be in collision when you look at it like that? So even at my best, I'm a creator of confusion rather than harmony. I got my wife and she wants to smoke cigarette, and I'm just thinking about her. And baby, you really need to get you some business, dude. You know, that's what it is, you know. I want for you more than you want for you. How many people's people wanted for them to be sober way before you were ready to be sober? That's collision. That's collision. Even at my best, I'm a creator of confusion rather than harmony. And so what do you know? So how do I get out of that? How do I get out of this God suit idea? Because I'd be in the delusion that, oh no, I'm not wearing the God suit. I've been doing this 27 years. I'm not, I've let go of that and then something to come to me. Dude, just cause you took a finger off the glove don't mean the suit is off. You got a suit on, you know, and you thinking cause one glove is partially off, you're not in the God's. No, dude, you know. You know. So why would I do that? Why do I stop playing God? What allows me to do it? This is the how and the why of it. We have to quit playing God. Why? It don't work. Not because it's virtuous. Not because there should have no other God before me. None of the biblical stuff. We have to quit playing God. Why? It don't work. Oh, I like that. It works for a guy like me. Just Dr. Feel It. How's that working for you, Ed? Oh, okay. Oh, okay. I can't make her talk the way I want her to talk. I can't make her expression be the way I want it to be. You know, because you can't even say, you can't say your lines. You can say the lines I want you to say, but you didn't have the appropriate enthusiasm with it. How's that working for you? And so that third step, in the personification of that, I took that third step for the first time. I did it with a group of people. And I got on my knees with a group, and we held hands, and I said, God, I offer myself to you. And what was so impressive to me about that prayer, I was a year sober. Well, I don't know if I was a year and a half, about a year sober, staying at my mama's house. Didn't have a job yet. Didn't have a pot to piss in. Didn't have a lot of money. I wasn't a vision for you. I wasn't all that. If I'd have walked up to any woman in here and said, baby, I offer myself to you, you'd have been like, dude, keep it moving. You know, but I got on my knees in that condition. Still doing, Kent said it. Thank God I didn't have to be right and come right to get right in the program Alcoholics Anonymous. The room would be empty. The room would be empty. I got on my knees and I said, God, do something with this piece of man. Still lying, still hoeing, still tripping, still doing all the things I do. Still untrustworthy, still irresponsible, still no integrity, still all that. Just put my feet on the path to work. And I said, God, do something with him. And he took me. Just like that. He took me. Did something with me. That's why I'm all in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why I stay all in Alcoholics Anonymous. Started getting some results after that. Started getting some chips of my own. And then when you get chips, job, wife, house, respect, self-respect. When you get chips, here's the cold thing. I know I'm just talking about myself now. Now I want to hold some of the chips in my own corner. I'm going to put her right here. I'm going to put the job right here. I'm not going to give the all in. All in, because I'm playing with house money. I'm playing with house money. Ed, I'm playing with house money. And then I want to hold it back. Y'all gave me what I have. The chips that I have, that I put at the table of life right now, I got them from you. I stay all in. All in and Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's the kind of deal, you know, that this thing right here embarked on a journey that I didn't know what I was in for. And that was in November 1987, a year sober. Me and my brother and some people in my mama's house cracked that book open, put my feet on a path to really go somewhere, put me in touch with a power that's transformational, put me in touch with a power that can do anything but pale, put me in touch with a power that has done for me what I can't do for myself, put me in touch with a power that not only has done it for me but continues to do it for so many people in here. That's what I like so much about it. It ain't tired and it don't discriminate. You know, here's my brother. I'm out.
Good morning. My name is Ronald White, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm supposed to follow that. Right, you know. Right, he started talking for a while. I want to say, woo! You know, it's just like. It was interesting when Ralph and I were talking with one another about the format that we were going to try to do this whole process in. He talked about it at the beginning about why we don't have the book up here and we're not reading passages and having people underline certain things and what have you. And we've done that in lots of workshops we've done over the years and stuff. But we knew that in three, like, hour and 15 minute sessions, you know, over the course of 3 days, there's no way we were going to be able to get through the whole book. And to talk about that. And so we had to try to think of what's the best way we can transmit an experience that we've had with the book over the course of the years. And it's basically just sharing with you guys. Sharing with you guys the things that we've gotten as a result of having been guided through the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous by some other men and women who did for us what we're trying to do for you. People just sat down with us and they just shared about an experience that made the book come alive for us. I remember that group of 12 people that we had formed at my mother's house back in 1987 in November. And in December, we had a flyer from these two guys, Joe McQuaney and Charlie Parmalee, who were doing a thing called The Big Book Comes Alive. And they were coming to Los Angeles, to Pasadena. And we had heard some things about that, and we all, as a group, went and paid this little admission fee, and we went and we got us a table at this presentation, and we all sat with our books, you know, in front of us with our highlighters and everything like that, and those men guided us on a journey through the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it made the book come alive. And the way that they talked about it, it wasn't academic, and it wasn't anybody who's heard Joe and Charlie, who heard it before, they know the way that they put it down. It's real down to earth, and it's real understandable, and it's not something that, like, you're being lectured or anything like that. And man, it made the, and that's what we're trying to do. Not trying to imitate Joe or Charlie, but trying to just go ahead and share an experience that we've had with the book. You can see we've only gotten all the way up to step three. So you can imagine, because there's so much meat in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, in this process of recovery. And I like the way that sounds, this process, because that's the way it is. It's always a looking back experience that I generally have that lets me know what the results are going to be. Because when I'm going through it, I don't even understand it. And I just do, like Ralph said, the cake mix kind of thing. You just do what you're told. And then later you get those results and then, it works. And that's kind of like the way it did for us. Ralph left off at step three, and I like the way that the book describes this step three experience, this coming to, because everything in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, as far as I'm concerned, is a coming to experience. Because I need that ass to be whooped. I'm sorry, can I say it that way? I can. Is it all right? Bill, is it okay? Okay, all right. I've already said it, and then I'm going to say, is it all right? Right? You know, better to ask for forgiveness than permission. right? And so, once under the lash of alcohol, you know, that's what ass whooping is. Just, you know, because that's the way my disease is. You know, it's not pretty. You know, it's a process that has driven me to the point of coming to my knees. And when I make that decision to turn my will and my life over, it has that analogy about that actor. And Ralph put it so well about me wanting to run everybody else's life, wanting to run the show, me wanting to be the leading man and tell everybody else what to do. And it's amazing how I forget everybody else has free will. And I'm so caught up in what I think you think about me and all this other kind of stuff, and I want to control that. And the Lord knows why I go through life being eternally unhappy, while I'll be eternally in collision with everybody else, because I want you so desperately that there will be 9 people in the room that love me. Let one of y'all, I told you yesterday, let one of y'all look like you nodding off. I ignore the 9, and I try to work on the, and I don't even like your ass. But you gotta like me. Right? I'm the only one, right? You know. And that's the story, that's always been the story of my life, unfortunately. Because I need to remember that everybody, all of God's children, have free will. Step 3. And it says, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion. And I like that one. Lying to myself. Because see, that's the coldest person that I tell you, those are really not that harmful. The lies I tell myself are so devastating, because that's that thing we talked about, this disease of perception, because my perceptor is off, because I lie to myself so much. I delude myself so much about what really is. Lord knows how many times I walked in a room and I thought she was looking at me. And am I the only one that knows that as soon as I introduce, she's going to want me and fall in love with me desperately, right? You know, don't even know me. But that's the story of my life. And so I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-pity, self-seeking. And it says that selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our trouble, right? And so when I see stuff like that, I really, like Ralph says, we question the Big Book. You don't just accept it, but I ask myself, is this true for me in my life? And I look back on the experience of the way that I've been living my life, and I ask myself whether or not this is true. And the book has the best line probably, and see, I always say that whenever we move to a different part. This is probably the most important line in the Big Book, right? A whole bunch of important lines. So our troubles, we think, of our own making, they arise out of ourselves, right? It talks about, invariably we find that sometime in the past we have placed ourselves in a position to be hurt, right? When folks retaliate on us, right? And then I have to examine, well, why did they do that, Ronald? And I like the fact that this concept of our troubles being of our own making, because guess what? If my troubles are of my own making, then the solution lies within me. It means I don't have to rely on you to get better before I can get better. So that gives me some hope. And so that's why I make this decision to turn my will and my life, my thoughts and my actions over to the care of this power. Step 4, that step that most people, when we get to Alcoholics Anonymous, that's the one we all cringe at, right? Because that's the one that everybody seems to make so awesome, so terrifying, this process of looking inward, at looking at myself, at finally taking this inventory of my grosser handicaps, as the book puts it. Resentments. Resentments are our greatest offender. Kills more alcoholics than anything else. And you would imagine that if I read something, and again, I question that. I have to ask myself, do I think that that's true? Do I look back on the experience of my life and do resentments? Well, first of all, what's a resentment? It's a process of me being pissed off over and over at a perceived slight or harm that you've done to me. And I like that word perceived because you don't even have to do nothing to me. Right? But if I think you did, it's the same as if you did. Right? It's just as dangerous. In fact, it's even more dangerous probably if you didn't do nothing, because then I'm really in trouble. Somebody walked in the door and then they started talking to each other and then they looked up at me and they laughed. I said, look at this That wasn't even one of my funny lines. There was a, what are you laughing about? All right, you know. Not even talking about me, not even thinking about me, not even, I'm the farthest thing from their mind or whatever. Somebody in here knows what I'm talking about, harboring resentments. And when I'm harboring resentments, that feeling of ill will and replaying it over and over, and just like instant replay when it first came out, the first time you see it is bad, but that second time in slow motion, oh! Right? You know, and they give different angles, and then now all of a sudden, no. Well, I think Kent was talking to him too. Look at him. And somebody knows that. And if somebody's friends with somebody you don't like, now all of a sudden they're on the list. They don't even have to do nothing to me, but you can't be friendly to somebody I don't like. And oh. See, I got some real ones in here today because you know what I'm talking about, right? And so this business of resentments can be infinitely grave. Because when harboring such feelings, I am shut off from the sunlight of the Spirit. Shut a drunk like me off from the sunlight of the Spirit long enough. And then there can come that thought, that obsession, that if my sunlight is off, I'm at risk. And so what happens for me is I need to do this inventory of my thinking. And that's all it is. It's a way of looking at this process that the book has outlined. That I love the way that it does it, too, because it's like peeling back an onion skin, where I need to peel back these layers of my thinking because underneath is where the real meat is. That's where the real harm is. And I need to let you know that once I get to, there's a four-column inventory, and I talk about who you are, what you did to me, how what it affects in me, what areas of myself are affected, whether or not it's my self-esteem, my pride, my pocketbook, my personal relationships, my sexual relationships, my security, my ambition, whether or not any of those things are adversely affected by what I perceive you did to me. And then I have to look at it a different way. The big book says I need to look, because I've lived my life in three columns. I've always lived my life not being mad at you because you harmed me in some way. You either stole some money from me, you took my girl, you took my job, you did something else that's made me be so angry at you that I can't let it go. Bruce Billingsley, his ass, when I was in junior high school. Oh, I'm the only one, right? Okay. Still remember his name, Bruce Billingsley. When I was in junior high school, I would be walking home to catch the bus home, and he would be waiting on my ass. And Bruce would extract, see that word, extract. Believe me, it was not willing. He would take my money every day, and I was so frightened, and I was in terror. You know, And I know, see, I wrote on that inventory, Bruce Billingsley always took my lunch money. I always, you know, and I talked about how he affected my pocketbook, my self-esteem, my pride, my personal relationships, my security. He affected every area of my life, right? And then I got to the fourth column. And I know that whenever I write always on any resentment, I'm being dishonest. Because he didn't always take my money. My head, over the years, it will begin to exaggerate situations, and it will always begin. And so, believe me, once I finished writing all that stuff, and really what it got down to was fear. That's why I'm carrying it around 59 years old, carrying around resentment that occurred when I was 14. And here we are 45 years down the line. Ooh, I almost hate saying that. 45 years later, still resenting him. Why am I still holding on to that? Because I still have these feelings of fear and intimidation whenever somebody confronts me in an aggressive manner, and I remember that experience. And so I hold on to this as protection, supposedly. I'm 59. I was at a high school, my 40-year high school reunion, and I'm sitting at this table. And as I'm sitting at this table, they had all these little name tags, you know, around the table. And there was a seat next to me that didn't have a name tag. And this guy came and sat down next to me, and we were all talking. I said, I recognize, what's your name? Bruce. What kind of God would, no, he's like. And I had been talking with this guy and having a good time and all this. And then there was Bruce Billing. And I looked at him. He didn't look threatening. Small, slight guy. You know, had the nerve to still have a Jerry curl. You know, it was just, I don't know if y'all know what a Jerry curl is. Bruce, this is 2012. What are you doing with a Jerry? And we talked, and I asked him if he remembered something, and he couldn't even remember it. And then I reminded him, do you remember? Oh, man, I'm sorry. You sorry? I've been carrying this shit around for 45 years. And you sorry? And he shared with me about how someone had done that to him. You know, not to get sympathy or anything like that, but just sharing, just talking. You know, and he said he was sorry. He you know, he realized it was screwed up. He didn't use those words, you know, but he said he realized it was screwed up, and he was just sorry for that, you know. And then when I started, it's funny how when he said that, it melted away some years of fear and resentment and what happened, because then the truth came in, and I thought about how often it was he really did it. It was occasionally. Wasn't every day. You know, I had made him into this monolithic monster. It's amazing what resentments will do. That's just one tiny example. You know, when I go and I write about, you know, the resentments I have, usually my list of people that I have these resentments with are usually family members. I have the greatest number. My wife, my children, you know, all these other, because if you get close to me and I have these expectations of behavior from you, you can never live up to my expectations. No one ever can. Because I am selfish and self-centered by my nature. And even if my motives are good, I had a resentment against my son because he wasn't bringing home the grades I thought he should bring. You know, and then I wrote down that it affected my my self-esteem. I thought I must not be a good parent because how come he can't be a straight-A student like I was? It affected my pride because I thought other people must have looked at me less than because, you know, if I was this great father, how come his son isn't bringing home grades? His teachers and his fellow classmates must think I'm a bad parent. It affected my personal relationships because I would come home and I would see him, and if he wasn't studying, if he wouldn't do anything, he would greet me and I would give him the cold shoulder because I can't show you affection if you're not meeting my expectations, because after all, you might think that it's all right with me, that you're okay with me. So now I'm withholding love from my son. I don't like the feeling that gives me when I share something like that. When I talk about just how chicken. But see, I need to do this process, this self-revealing process, you know, revealing it to myself, because I don't even know that about me all the time. And how many people have been away from a loved one or family member and you tell yourself, well, I'm going to do better this time. When I get home, I'm going to be affectionate. I'm going to do this, that, and the other. As soon as you walk in, it seemed like you just revert right back what you said you weren't going to do. Because in and of myself, I don't have the power to change myself. I don't have self-will. Again, it's going back to doing exactly what I just made this decision that I wasn't going to do. Turning my will and my life, my thoughts and my actions over to the care of this power. And once again, I start thinking that it's self-will. That all of a sudden I can just think myself into good living. No, I have to live myself into good thinking. And so there's some other things that I have to do. The inventory process in and of itself is not a solution to my problem. But it's necessary for me to get to the solution. Because these are the things that are blocking me from the power. That's the whole purpose of inventory. To discover the obstacles in my path. The things that are standing in between me and the power. Because if I don't see, that's been the story of my life. I'm this ostrich. I'm the guy who just wants to stick his head in the sand. And if I don't see it, it ain't there. If I don't look for it, you know, there's a lot of people that, well, why should I mess with it? I'm going okay right now. Are you? Why dig up some stuff and start some trouble if it's not really? It's like that bad fruit that's in the refrigerator down there in the thing with all the good fruit. Let it stay there long enough. Everything else in my life starts to get infected. Everything else. It starts to bleed into everything else that I have. And you start smelling that stuff and everything and try to pretend like, oh, that's just that's a new fragrance. Self-delusion. Lying to myself once again. And so this inventory process is extremely important for a guy like me. Because once I start writing and once I get to that fourth column, and there's nothing else in this entire process that counts for more but honesty. Kent talked about it last night. There are three essentials for recovery: honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And I have to apply that in each one of these steps that we do, because if I don't, if I am not rigorously honest with who? With myself. It says, I need to do this thing withholding nothing. And so when I'm writing, I need to write as if, you know, my life depended on it. Because why? It does. Because it does. My spiritual life. And guess what? If I don't straighten out spiritually, I'm doomed physically and mentally. And I don't always want to see that. I can't always see that. And so this process gives me, each step gives me the spiritual power to do the next step. So after I do that third step, getting off my knees, I have to immediately go into step four. Because if I don't, my ego doesn't want to die. Ego will try to protect itself. And so this humbling process that the inventory process is, because I told you, when I write that stuff about my son, and then I write the things about my wife and write the things about my brother and write the things. I had so many resentments against Ralph. I didn't have so many resentments against him. But I mean, I've always lived, and I heard Kent talk about living in his brother's shadow. and that was comforting. Living in Ralph's shadow as I've grown up, he's always a year ahead of me. He's always talked about me and Reggie. Every school we would go to, each teacher knew when I came in the class, Ralph had been there right before me. And I have to measure up to what he's done. In some ways, that's both a blessing and it's a curse. Because in some ways, the road is made easier, but in other ways, it's made more difficult. Because now I have something I have to live up to. You're given something, but then maintaining it and keeping it up is. And so I have resentments against him in this comparison thing. I always come to the convention. Oh, you're Ralph's brother. Ralph? No, he's my brother. No. A blessing and a curse. I'm proud of him, but at the same time, I want my own identity. So how do you balance those and then start feeling guilty of being resentful? Anybody go there? Start beating yourself up for resenting somebody that you love. And then I want to get, that's that self-pity thing. See, I've got so much stuff I have to deal with, but the book simplifies it for me. Just write. Just write, Ronald. And guess what? I always tell people that I sponsor and what have you. Guess what? This isn't a perfect process. Some people think, oh, I have to have my columns lined up perfectly, and I have to do this. And if it's not, oh, I can't spell anything wrong. You're the only person that's going to look at it. You're going to read it to a sponsor or to somebody else, but you don't hand it to them and tell them, okay, that's my fifth step. You can read it, you know. And so what happens for me is I tell all the people I sponsor, look, it's in the seeking. That's where the relief comes. It's in the seeking. As long as I'm a seeker, God does not make too hard terms those who earnestly seek him. Not know him. Seek him. So it's in the process of seeking him that I grow closer. The closer we drew to him, the more he revealed himself to me. And so it's in this process of being rigorously honest, as much as I can, as much as I have, giving you what I got. And it's in that process of this writing, peeling back these layers. And finally, and now sometimes we hate the book so much because it tells us things that I don't want to have pointed out for me. Because after I do those first three columns, and it knows that I'm going to have difficulty looking at myself now, looking at the so-called part I played in. What part did I play in somebody molesting me? What part did I play in somebody killing my child? What part did I play in, you know, in their unspeakable tragedies and things that people inflict upon us that I, what part could I possibly play in that? I don't want to, you know, and there's a prayer that's in the book. It says, we need to look at this from an entirely different angle. Perhaps this person was a sick person. They, like ourselves, that's the part I hate. They, like ourselves, were perhaps spiritually sick. Why do they want to put it that way? We got a gang of people who sit in this particular room, this particular morning, who I suspect have inflicted harm on a couple of people in their lives, who have done some things that they're not particularly proud of during the course of their disease, and sometimes outside of their illness, in their sobriety. And thank God for forgiveness of others. You know, I know my heart, and I know that, you know, I do things that I'm not particularly proud of and what have you, and I've got so many people who embrace me. I'm going through some stuff right now. And thank God for the love and the comfort of those who know and understand that I'm human. But see, but I don't want to, you know, when it comes to me, see, my selfishness and my self-centeredness make me think that I'm special, that you're not supposed to harm me or mine, that you're not supposed to do anything. After all, I'm one of God's children. How can you do that? How can you harm me? And so when I have to say that prayer so that I'll look at you in a different way, you who have harmed me, who I've perceived have harmed me, and I look at it from this entirely different angle, and then I'm able to disregard the wrong of others entirely, and I have to look for the part that I played in it. A lot of times the part is I simply don't want to let it go because I think that it's going to harm me again. I don't want to forget because you're not going to get what you got coming to you. And so I want to hold on to this resentment all of life. And who is it killing? My friend Strange says it's like taking poison waiting on you to die. Bruce didn't know nothing about that resentment. Bruce living his life. I'm holding on to it, hating him all these years. He didn't forgot all about that. Ain't a big deal. Wasn't a big deal to him. Huge deal for me. And so who is the resentment killing? Me or Bruce? Killing me. Blocking me. Keeping me in everlasting fear. And so what do I want to do? Do I want to be right or do I want to be free? That's the question you have to ask yourself with this in this business of resentments. Do I want to be right or do I want to be free? And freedom is what I'm looking for in this process. Believe me, I've been in everlasting, I've been imprisoned up here and in here all of my life. And I need some freedom. Freedom from the bondage of what? Of self. Not from the bondage of anybody else. Freedom from the bondage of self. That's what that means. And so that's what this process is. The abolishment of this selfishness and this self-centeredness. That's what the inventory process is designed to do. And so once I finish peeling all that back, guess what? We got another inventory for you, Ronald. Everybody talks about that resentment inventory, and we spend a lot of time. But there's another one, fear. Probably the biggest thing that's in my life is fear, because I'm afraid of everything. Don't want to portray it. Don't want to let you know it. Except I am so frightened of everything that all of my actions are contrary. Now, I will mask it with anger, with bravado, with humor. With all those other kinds of things. Anybody here know what I'm talking about? Right? You know, and so I will always try. I don't want to just let you know. Look, man, I'm scared. You know, that's not a popular subject for the guys. Hey, man, I'm scared. Shoot. You know, because everybody's afraid that you're going to take advantage of me then. Once I tell you that I'm afraid, then you're going to really get me. It's been my experience that once I express that, especially around the people who love me and stuff, I get just the opposite reaction. And so I need to take the power out of the secret. I need to take the power out of the darkness and bring it to the light. And there's another inventory, a sex inventory. Now, it's not as sexy as it sounds. It's my conduct in sex relationships and relationships in those in which people I have sex. And I think the book has us right about that, because that's where my selfishness really shows up, in those kinds of relationships. You know, I know that a lot of people extend it and they say you can write it in any relationship that you have, except write it in those relationships you have with the individuals over the years past and in the present that you've had sexual relationships with. And you will find that I find that my conduct in those relationships is extremely selfish, controlling, dishonest, manipulative, all of those things. And so those 9 questions that the book asked me to write about are very revealing for me and are instructive for me in constructing an ideal, not an idea, but an ideal for how I want my future relationships to be. What am I bringing to the relationship? Not what am I getting from the relationship? See, I've always wanted to look at my partner and think, what is she bringing to me? As opposed to, what am I bringing to the table? It's amazing, when I get better, you get better. Anybody ever notice that? When I get better, you get better. When I concentrate on me, you seem to improve. And so the purpose of these inventories, once I write them, is to not just sit at them and admire them 10 minutes. Okay. Not to sit and admire them, but it's to, in a fifth step, share it with God and another human being. And in the chapter Into Action, where it starts talking about step five, it starts telling me that a solitary self-appraisal, we think, is insufficient. In other words, if I just write the inventory and don't share it with nobody, that ain't good enough. Because me, just examining me, there's something, I mean, it's okay, I suppose, a self-examined life is better than an un-self-examined life. However, there is something that happens in the process of sharing with another human. And some people say, well, doesn't God know it anyway? What do they mean, share with God and another human being, the exact nature of our wrong? Once I write it, God knows everything. Anybody ever think that they are holding something back from God? Kind of think if you hold it in the corner of your mind that God won't know about it, right? I don't do it for God. I do it for me. It's amazing how speaking the words out loud, it's a humbling process. It's a process of submission. It's a process of turning it over. See, with the third step, the other steps demonstrate the turning over process. You know, I speak the words in step three, except the process of carrying out the decision are in the other steps. And so, once again, once I do the process, and there is something that happens in terms of, it says the person only thought he had lost his egoism. He only thought that he had lost his fear. Only thought that he had humbled himself. By the writing process, it's when I share it with somebody else, there is something else that happens to me in the sharing. First person I did a fifth step with was one of the ladies who facilitated this first workshop that Ralph and I had over our mother's house. This woman named Michelle. Michelle is a gay woman who was a heroin addict from New York. I never used no heroin. I wasn't from New York. I wasn't gay. I wasn't a woman. But there was something about her spirit that connected with me. She had me over to her apartment where I had this beat up notebook with that first fifth step that I really just, And I sat on Michelle's living room floor and I poured my heart out to her. And I'm reading these things that I felt so embarrassed and so ashamed about. And she just nodded her head and she just, you know, listened. And occasionally she would ask me a question or she would say something. And I cannot tell you the freedom that I felt when I left from her house. How she made me feel so safe and secure and felt like I could trust her. And I felt like a different man when I left from there. I've done many, many fifth steps over the years. And I felt different emotions after I've done each one of them. I cannot share with you the feeling that I had after I did that first one. You know what I felt? I felt like I was committed to my sobriety. I felt like that decision that I had made in step three, that I was really, like Ralph said, I was all in. I really felt like that I was all in. I felt like I had been living, talking this program before, but after I did that, I felt like I was in. And this was after a year. Well, after a year, I was about a year and a half sober before I did that first inventory. We were about a year sober when we started that workshop. We didn't get to the fifth step until we had been in that work maybe about 6 months. And there was something that happened for me. I discovered some things about myself. These defects of character. These flaws in my being. These natural traits that all of us have as human beings, step six, that have gone awry over the years, especially in a guy like me. I shared with you guys yesterday that vivid imagination that I have and all of those things that I've imagined about myself and these character traits that I've wanted to have about being, suave and debonair and all this other kind of stuff, right? Well, I may not be tall, dark, and handsome. One out of three ain't bad. You pick which one, okay? All right. Because, see, I was going to say two out of three, but that would be too easy, right? You know. But I need to let you know that I have instincts that have gone awry. I always want more. I am excessive in my desires, in my wants, in my need, all of these kinds of things. And I discovered some stuff about myself, especially in the fear area. I didn't know how rife my life was with fear. And when I did that inventory, that fifth step with Michelle, and I discovered these things in that fourth column in step six, and I knew I had to say another prayer. I knew I had to say another prayer. See, I like the way, like I said, when I described it as this peeling back the onion skin process, because every step is a coming to process. And I think that every time when I first came in off that ass whooping and I knew I was powerless and I had to come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, step two, a coming to process. And I did that third step, made that decision, and I did that inventory in the fifth step. And again, it was a coming to process. I had to come to, there's some stuff wrong with me. And now I need another prayer. Just like the third step prayer, the seventh step prayer. Because see, in and of myself, I can't make myself come right. I can't make myself change and become, I need God's intervention. So just like in the third step where I ask for God to intervene, I once again give myself to Him. And that process, if you did a fifth step like me and discover some stuff about yourself, you need some prayer. And that seven-step prayer is designed to get me to where I heard Ralph talk about the big girl panties and the big boy pants. Get to step eight, okay? Get to the eighth and the ninth step. That's when you're going to really... See, we're going to talk some more about that tomorrow because our time is just about up today. So this process just makes me so passionate. About it. Is anybody else passionate about their recovery? That's right. And that's what I can bring, this willingness that I have to bring to the table all the time. Here I am. I'll be in how many days? This is July the 5th in 9 days. I never say if God's willing. God's always willing. If I do what I'm supposed to do in 9 days, I'll be 28 years sober. And so don't clap, because I want that in 9 days. All right. I'm not asking for no pre-birthday clap. But I try even now to stay as passionate and enthusiastic about this process as I was when I first came in. See, I hope that we're exuding that to you. I hope that you can feel that. See, because that's the experience that I've had with this book, with this process over the years, man. And it keeps me enthused. And as far as that's concerned, you guys have kept me enthused, too. Thank you.